Hello everyone, welcome to Reality Bites episode 6. Today I'm talking to Dr. Rajiv Malhotra and we are going to be discussing an extremely important issue. Should Hindus be using the term Hindu phobia or the term Hindu mesia to talk about the historic persecution and the hate that Hindus have been facing globally and at home? So thank you, Rajiv sir. Thank you for talking to me for the second time.
This is an honor, Nupur. You are very articulate, you're very clear thinking, and you're getting right to the point, and you don't hesitate pushing on a topic. And so I'm looking forward to this.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much, Rajiv. So thank you for sparing your time. We know you're extremely busy. Now, I think the Hindu community on the whole has historically missed the significance of lexicon and the words that we are supposed to use to articulate our historical persecution. So how important do you think is lexicon in defining our problems in a manner that the global community sort of understands what the Hindu community has gone through historically for the past 1,000 plus years?
You know, brand names are a substitute for going deep into an issue, into a product. If you know a certain brand is means a certain thing, it could mean a very expensive brand, it could mean very inexpensive brand, it could mean very reliable brand, it could mean a brand for, young girls, it could mean whatever. So a brand is a term that conveys a whole message in one phrase, one word. And this branding, people spend a lot of money creating these brands, and then it becomes part of your unconscious, the consumer's unconscious. So when that brand is invoked, it brings out a whole lot of messages, a whole lot of assumptions. So similarly, words can be branded. And the West is extremely good at that. The left in particular has been very good at coinage and coming up with brands. And so we haven't done that in today's world. We used to do it in the ancient past. People were very skillful in the use of language. But today, we've taken the back seat. Even things like, are we right wing? I mean, I don't think we are right wing or left wing. I'm flying on both wings. I mean, I don't see why I have to make a choice. And if you lo really look at the meaning of right wing in the context of how it started in the West, it really doesn't apply to us. But we've accepted that. So we're accepting the coinage that others have come up with, and rather than creating our own. And therefore, we are sort of a consumer of somebody else's framework, and in fact, empowering it by merely using it. So I think you've raised a very important point. We need to take control of the discourse, and that includes coming up with the right terms, the right phrases. Some of them are old ones we have to revive. Like we've talked about in my case, we've talked about Purva Paksha. It's an old term, but we've revived it and it's become very powerful. So, and then some are new terms that we have to coin.
As you said, the left does this really effectively. They've understood that the lexicon is a part of a strategy where you can articulate a subliminal messaging to the entire world without really saying it. Now, for example, in the Delhi anti-Hindu riots, where there was an entire conspiracy to burn Hindus, to murder Hindus, and to teach kafirs a lesson, the global left managed to package it as an anti-Muslim pogrom. Now, they didn't use the word genocide, they didn't use the word massacre, they specifically used the word pogrom because it tells the global community that the Muslims are essentially the new Jews that are being cleansed by the Hindus. It alludes to the massacre and the cleansing of Jews in Russia and Eastern Europe in the 19th and 20th century. Now, a lot of average consumers, readers, viewers would not particularly understand the importance of using that word pogrom by the left. But it did the job for the global community. It did the job for the power corridors that the left was trying to huckle to. So, how important do you think, and how do we really balance using terminology that the average consumer, reader, viewer can understand versus terminology and lexicon that is necessary for the subliminal messaging that you need to send out globally to make sure that you can mainstream the conversation and narrative around your own persecution?
You know, I think you've framed the issue very nicely. There is an explicit communication, which people understand. And then there is a subliminal, implicit, kind of unconscious communication. And this is very important. Now, there are legal consequences also. So if you were to use the word pogrom as in your example, and this catches on, and you know, most people don't know too much. They don't have a whole lot of knowledge. They cannot you know, factually agree or disagree, but it's a nice term used by some credible people with some good affiliations. They come from very prestigious media, so you know it has currency. It gets currency, and once it gets currency, it gets traction. Then it travels, and you know, far and wide, it becomes part of the curriculums in universities. Students start using it. Media people casually use it. So it becomes common. It becomes sort of like a default position. In other words, in a conversation you're having, when people want to look like they're very smart, they will start quoting these things because they assume that it's a given. It's sort of like the normal position that becomes the normal. You see, that's the problem, that these terms become like the normal way of referring to something. And we have suffered a lot. So I think making this problem, bringing our people's attention to this problem is very serious.
So what do you think is more important, using lexicon and terminology that your average reader in India can identify with? Because we are talking about Hindu persecution historically. So should we be using terms that your average reader in India, your average Hindu in India can understand and relate to? Or should we be more careful using these terms, which send out a message to the global community as to what we are trying to say, like the left did with the Delhi riots? They specifically used the word pogrom unanimously and universally. Every Islamist, every leftist, every media house that spoke about the Delhi anti-Hindu riots, and they wanted to prove that it was against the Muslims, they specifically used the term pogrom. So for reasons we discussed. Yeah.
So I think, as you mentioned, there are two audiences and there are two purposes, and both are important. I mean, you definitely want to bring your own people along. You want to speak in common language that they understand, whatever is the Aam Aadmi buzz, you know, whatever will work for them. And then you also want to speak to the global community because you want to have an influence there. You want to counter, because we have been very lazy. Our Hindu leaders worldwide, those who are in positions of official, formal appointment, whether they are with the Sangh Parivar, whether they are the government, or whether they are the gurus, these are the people who got adhikar, they got the authority in the eyes of the world. They have not done a good job of this, of messaging for the global consumption. They have not done that. And so individuals like us can do so much, but we do not have the official, we're not officially authorized to represent a culture. So if there's a debate on CNN, I can get in on merit, but then they'll say, well, you're only representing yourself. The Indian ambassador is not willing to come. Guru X and Y is not willing to come. The Sangh people don't go there and do this. They feel embarrassed. And so the people with the adhikar are not doing this job. And so ordinary people are doing the best they can. Now, there is this need in the global messaging to use terms which will work. It is practical. It is not a question of what does it literally mean. It's a question of, will it work? Can I piggyback on a trend? So pogrom is a trend. It's a very powerful word. It's a vicious word. So can I piggyback on that? And you see, it's not about whether it really was or wasn't a pogrom, but that's what works. So I would say that the pragmatics of the situation are twofold. There is a pragmatic in the domestic, you know, Aam Aadmi marketplace of ideas. You want to bring those people along. You want enough of that support for various reasons. And you also want to explain to the global community, which is very sophisticated, and they have their own kind of, you know, language, so to speak. And you need to understand what exactly are they saying, reading between the lines. What are the implications of what they're saying, and how should we counter it wisely? So there are both those domains.
So it's interesting you spoke about us identifying as right wing, because essentially, if you really go by the definition of right wing, it would be the Islamists who should ideally be called right wing and not Hindus.
Yes. Yes.
And we've very happily accepted that tag, sadly.
Well,
if you look at the
classically what the left wants, I mean, they want egalitarianism, and Hindu dharma is very egalitarian. If you look at what is a liberal in the American sense, a liberal goes is a vegetarian, goes and does yoga and all these things, and they are part of this new age liberal. Well, that is all Hindu stuff. In fact, it came from here. So how come they've taken many Hindu ideas and practices and philosophies, incorporated them as at the very heart of being a liberal white person, and yet at the same time branded us as some kind of right wings and fascists and all those things? This is something our thought leaders must pay attention to. How is this happening, and how do we counter it?
In fact, it was very interesting to me that during this Israel-Hamas war, there were individuals from the left and the Islamist nexus who were going on to brand the Jews as fascists and Hitleresque. So it was very interesting to me that they would talk about the Jews who are being persecuted and call them with the epithets that they gave to the very man who persecuted them years ago and decades ago. So it was very interesting to me how this play of words takes place. So Raju, so you and I have been going back and forth on this discussion about the usage of the word Hindophobia versus the usage of the word Hindumisia. Now, before we get into that discussion, I'd like to give a short primer for all our listeners who might not know. Phobia is essentially an uncontrollable, irrational fear of either an object, a person, a group of people, a situation, etc. So you have a fear of heights, it's called a phobia. You have a fear of spiders, it's called a phobia. And Hindophobia essentially means a phobia of Hindus, which is an irrational fear of Hindus. Phobia, of course, comes from, I believe, the word phobos, which means fear. It's and the opposite of that would be philia, which is love. On the other hand, misia, Hindu misia, it comes from the Greek word. Misia comes from the ancient Greek word misos, which means hatred. Now, misia is generally used as a prefix rather than a suffix. So when you hear of words like misogyny, misanthropy, etc., it plays on the word misia. Now, the debate is that should we be using the word Hindophobia or the word Hindumisia to talk about our historical persecution, to talk about the hate speech, etc., that Hindus encounter on a regular basis. Now, before we go into Hindumisia and talking about the differences in the two terms and what should be used, I think it would bode well for all of us to understand how and why Hindophobia as a term started being used. And Dr. Raji was one of the first people and one of the early adopters of the term Hindophobia. And so, sir, could you tell us why you thought that Hindophobia would be an appropriate word to talk about the kind of persecution that Hindus face?
Yeah, I think.
And how long ago did it start, and why did it come about?
Yeah, so in the 1990s, when I was looking at, all kind of bias in the school systems, and the bias is not just hatred, bias also includes fear. I mean, they are basically saying Dalits have fear of Brahmins, Muslims have fear of Hindus, minorities in India are persecuted by Hindus. That is all fear. That is all to accuse Hindus of pogroms is to instill fear. I mean, the whole woke is based on fear that we are people of privilege. We have structures of privilege. The Vedas are oppressive. The whole idea of oppressor, oppressed. Oppressor is the one who's oppressing you, and oppressed is the one who's a victim. That is the Marxist language in which wokeism is being defined. And Hindus are considered the oppressor. Well, if you are oppressor and I'm oppressed, obviously I have to fear you. Obviously, it is. So it is not like fear is not there. It is definitely there. And the dismantling Hindutva is not because they are irrational people and they're a bunch of useless, unscientific, idol worshippers. That's not a reason to dismantle them. the dismantling is because they are a threat to society. They're actually a menace. They're actually a threat to society. And when you get the U.S. State Department and all kinds of people going to the Indian government and saying, you know, we don't like this and we warn you and this and that, and you're a human rights oppressor. Well, that is because that all that is instilling a fear of Hindus. So the Hindu phobia, even in the literal sense of the word phobia, is valid. It is happening. And I don't think we should deny that Hindu phobia is real. It exists and we should fight back. As far as the history is concerned, in the 90s, when I was tracking these things, you know, I'm very fond of learning new stuff and meeting new friends and particularly understanding how other people are playing the game. So I studied the Japan Foundation, the Korea Foundation, how they're working in this country, Tibet House, the China Institute, you know, how they're working, and the Islamic. There was a Council on Islamic Relations and Education. I became friends with a lot of those people. One of the persons was Akbar Ahmed. Now, he is a Pakistani, and he was the Pakistani High Commissioner to UK. And after he retired, this is some decades ago, he came to the United States as a visiting professor at Princeton University, right in my neighborhood. So we became friends. He would take me out to lunch. We came to my house. We became very good friends. In fact, very nice, decent, gentle, soft-spoken person, like a diplomat would be. Now, one day he invites me to a book launch or something, some big book event in Princeton University, where they're going to give an award to somebody who has exposed Islamophobia. I wasn't familiar with that term. So I said, what is this going on? He said, well, you know, we want to create a whole movement and we want to coin the term Islamophobia and create a whole movement to push back against those who are criticizing us and belittling us and all that stuff, all the negativities that people are spreading about Islam. We want to brand it Islamophobia and fight back. So one of the things that they were doing was giving a book award every year to whichever person, especially they would pick a leftist and give them a lot of rewards if they exposed what was considered Islamophobia. So I thought this is very interesting, very clever. I mean, earlier in our conversation, we discussed the importance of coining words. And I figured this is what these guys are up to. So I figured, I told him, I said, you know, but all the examples you're giving of people making fun of Muslims and in school they're being bullied and so on. Somebody makes fun of some symbol of theirs. We face that too. We Hindus face that too. So he said, well, but then that's up to you to do something about it. So I came home and I did a search on Hindu phobia. And I thought, you know, if there's a lot of Islamophobia, because he showed me on his computer, there's a lot of Islamophobia discussion going on. So I thought there would also be Hindu phobia. It's a very natural thing. You replace the word Islam with Hindu. And I found there were no hits at all. There were no hits. It was not a term being used. Now, decades later, someone told me that Hindu phobia had been used in the 1800s or something. Maybe it had been, but it wasn't in active use. It certainly wasn't in active use in the context I was in. So for me, it was a brand new innovation to coin the term Hindu phobia, even though later I found out that somebody had used it long ago, but it became out of use. So that's how the term Hindu phobia started. Everywhere he would go and talk about Islamophobia, I would sit in the audience and I would raise my hand and say, you know, can we also take on Hindu phobia the same way? And I would give examples. Very similar examples to the ones he was giving. If he would give examples of school children being bullied, Muslims, I would give examples of Hindu children being bullied. If he would give examples of stereotyping in the media, making fun of them, I would give the same examples. So I piggybacked on the activism of the Islamophobic movement and gained currency. So we became very successful. People today, everybody in the media who's a Hindu knows the term. It's the result of about 30 years of using it. So coinage and using creates brand value because a lot of people start using it. The biggest benefit to the term Hindu phobia was when people we call Hindu phobic, like Wendy Doniger and all these kind of people, started getting scared of it. They started saying, oh, I don't want to be called Hindu phobic. You know, if I say this, they'll call me Hindu phobic. I better avoid it. So our opponents and our targets of Hindu phobia started giving us value by taking it seriously. I mean, they could have trivialized it and not taken it seriously. But they started attacking me. I got personal attacks all over the place, every which way, all kind of allegations against me because I branded them Hindophobic. So I knew I'm onto something, because if you call the opponent something and it really hits him hard, then you know you're onto something. So I decided that this must continue, and that's how we built a whole movement around it. And so we own the term Hindophobia.com, and we have several books on it, Academic Hindophobia. My focus was Academic Hindophobia, because I'm able to show that that is where knowledge starts, and it goes into the school system, then they teach journalists, and then it media Hindophobia. There's a lot of Hindophobia in the media, in think tanks, in policy making, you see. So this has been a successful coinage for us. I'll tell you how we used it effectively. About a year or two ago, there was a bill in the United States Congress banning Islamophobia and making it a criminal offense. It would not be just a bad manners and bad etiquette. It would be a federal crime to be applied worldwide. And the bill said that a special cell should be installed to monitor Islamophobia worldwide, and this should be part of the State Department. So this would be like a whole surveillance, worldwide surveillance. And if this became law, then if somebody like you said something about Islam in India, you know, and they put a case on you, then this United States State Department would prosecute it. I mean, whether they could succeed is another matter, but they would internationally prosecute it. And this would become a federal crime in the United States. Now, this is a very serious matter. You know, I have put this out in my book, some recent books also. The bill passed the lower house. It passed the Congress with one vote opposing it and the majority agreeing with it, and a large number of people just abstaining from it. So it passed. And that's very big, big news. But in the Senate, Senator Cory Booker, an African-American New Jersey senator, I know him well. I've funded his campaigns. We know each other. I've supported him in the past. He put it on the floor. And I was so disgusted, because I don't think he knew enough about it, about the whole, all the ramifications. So I put out a counter to that. And this is where I said, if you want to ban Islamophobia, you should also ban Hindophobia. Why is one religion more important than the other? Had I started with Hindumisia, they could have said, okay, it's not the same thing. You see, but when I say Islamophobia has these is a problem, if somebody is accused, then there should be these consequences. Then by the same token, Christian phobia, Hindu phobia, Buddhist phobia, Sikh phobia, etc., should also be. And that's a way to win an argument. Because now I convinced people like Senator Cory Booker, his office people, that you would be insulting Hindus by only patronizing and protecting Muslims from this Islamophobia and not giving Hindus the same benefit. So therefore you should broaden the language. Now the moment the Senate people started thinking about, okay, let's also ban Hindophobia, the whole deal died. Because the people who were into it, behind backing it, was the leftist Islamic conspiracy, that nexus of the leftist and the Islamic. And the last thing they wanted to do was to be on the radar with people like me accusing them of Hindophobia. Okay, then they felt that this whole thing will backfire. So the bill died. And that's a success we pulled off. We haven't received a whole lot of publicity for it, but we pulled off the success by simply putting Hindophobia on par with Islamophobia very successfully. And the legal people said, yep, this makes sense. If they want to do Islamophobia, then they should also do Hindophobia. And then the whole deal collapsed. So I'm giving you examples where I have been able to use this in schools, in university debates, on media. And I feel that the people who are promoting Hindumisia do not have that experience. I'm sorry, they're good people. I'm sure they mean well. But they haven't had this 30, 40 years of experience of getting out of their own cocoon and into the mainstream and fighting battles and coming back successfully. I haven't heard them win a single battle And I think that if you start up the, if you start this new Hindu Misia bandwagon, you'll confuse people. We lose the 30 years momentum we've built, and we'll have to start all over again. And I'm not happy with that.
So before we move on to Hindu Misia, now, especially after the Israel and Hamas war and all of that, you do see this sort of momentum in trying to talk about radical Islam and talk, you know, sort of counter radical Islam. And for the past few years, there has also been certain momentum in trying to say that Islamophobia is a myth. Now, we all know that Islamophobia as a term was popularized by the Muslim Brotherhood to skirt any sort of criticism of Islam. Now, when we talk about Islamophobia, the obvious counter to that is that the fear of Islam is essentially not irrational, given the history of Islam for so many centuries, the beheadings, the rapes, the wars, the campaign against kafirs, the jizya, and all of that, the kind of unbridled violence. The fear of Islam is not irrational. If you don't fear Islam, you end up like Mahashay Rajpal with your head not attached to your torso, essentially. And therefore, the fear is not irrational. Now, the moment you start talking about Hindophobia, it's almost as if the two can't really go hand in hand. So you can't particularly say that Islamophobia does not exist and attempt to discredit that extremely draconian word which skirts any sort of criticism, and at the same time use the same lexicon to talk about the persecution, the historic persecution and hate speech against Hindus. So how do we rationalize that? How do we continue to use the word Hindophobia and so, yet continue our efforts to discredit the draconian Islamophobia bandwagon?
So, you know, you have to update your knowledge. Our people need to update their knowledge with the book Snakes in the Ganga, where we're explaining the woke movement is attacking us by accusing us of being, they are actually saying that Dalits are suffering from Hindophobia. Dalits are the targets and victims of Hindophobia. Look at the language, oppressor, oppressed. Now, oppressor is to be feared. So Nupur, you are being called oppressor. Your culture is an oppressor. So how can you say they're not accusing you of phobia? They're not having phobia. They are making the allegation that you are creating Hindu phobia in me, the Dalit, or me, the Muslim. You want me to be afraid of you. You come from the oppressor community, and you have Sanskrit language is an oppressive language. It was used by the Brahmins to oppress the Dalits and women. So there is oppression of women. There is oppression of Dalits. There is oppression of Christians. There is oppression of Muslims. So basically, the entire dismantling Hindutva, dismantling Hinduism, attack on Hinduism is based on a theory of oppression. And how can an oppressor not be feared? So I don't think that you can decouple fear. You see, negative is a very loose term. You can be negative. You can be negative and say, I don't like their idols and they're very ugly people and they do all these weird things and these mumbo-jumbo pujas they do don't make any sense and their symbols are, you know. That is, I mean, people have a right to say all that and make fun of each other. But this becomes a legal allegation against Hindus because of the charge that you are oppressors. And because the whole human rights movement internationally, these UN and all these kind of people, they have accepted this. You know, this Sundare Rajan, the lady who's done this equality labs, she's gone and presented her entire thesis on why Hindus are violent and why the whole Hindu dharma from the text, from the Vedas. She's gone and done workshops at World Bank. A six-part workshop for the paid her a lot of money. I have the videos for that, from that, where she says that World Bank should make it part of the policy when it gives a loan, when it finances international loans in various countries, it should look for whether there is something like Hindu-phobia going on. And so if a certain government or some organization somewhere in India were applying for a World Bank loan, one of the criteria should be, are they practicing Hindu-phobia? And who would be evaluating that? Well, it would obviously be NGOs, these leftist Muslim type NGOs. They would be the ones giving World Bank a report. And so what would happen if that became law, if that became policy, is that it would affect the financing availability for Hindus, because they would all be considered saffron and Hindu-phobic, I mean, violent people because they are oppressors. So I would say, look at the thesis, the theory behind wokeism, and you cannot escape the allegation of being oppressor, of being, you know, the party, the group, the identity that is creating victimhood in the rest of the people. So that I would say that it may be our wishful thinking that people just hate us because of reasons of logic. Maybe they don't understand our religion and all that. But let me tell you, things have changed in the last 30, 40 years. When I use the term Hindu-phobia, you could argue to some extent that there isn't real phobia being propagated, but it is just sort of jokingly, they'd say that this and that happens. Although there were women's conferences all the time saying that unless you dismantle the male patriarchy, Hinduism, you know, there is fear of that among the women. And they would constantly bring out rape victims and whatever going on and blame it on Hinduism and some woman got burnt or whatever happened, you know. So they would do that, victimhood, parading victimhood. And now, about 15, 20 years ago, this took a new turn and caste was added. And then after 9/11, when the Muslims joined the leftists to create this woke movement in the United States, Muslims were added. So Christians were added. So now, you know, you just cannot make the case that there is no Hindu-phobia. Because if you say there is no Hindu-phobia, then you are saying that Hindus are not being accused of being oppressors and murderers and rapists. But, you know, Suraj Yengde at Harvard goes around giving talks that 5 lakh Dalit women have been raped by Brahmins, according to him, in the last 10 years. I mean, he just come up with all these kind of wild allegations. So we have to call them Hindu-phobics.
Now, again, phobia is in itself, it means it's an irrational fear where there is no basis of it. So if we say that these people genuinely fear Hindus because they believe that Hindus are oppressors, even then, do you think that there is some sort of dissonance between what we think they feel, which is fear of Hindus because they genuinely believe that Brahmins were oppressors or Hindus were oppressors, so on and so forth, and the word phobia, which essentially means it's an irrational fear? Because one of the arguments that has been put forth by those who are talking about the term Hindumesia is that we are not just talking about hate speech. We are not just talking about criticism like, you know, those talking about Islamophobia often talk about. We are talking about real life violence. We are talking about murders, rapes, beheadings, calls for genocide, genuine oppression for thousands of years. So do you think the term Hindu-phobia, which is an irrational fear of Hindus, is inadequate to capture this sort of institutionalized and systemic oppression of Hindus that we wish to mainstream and encompass in our narrative? Do you think it's inadequate in that way?
No. And there's two parts to the conversation. First, you know, whether a phobia is rational fear or irrational fear depends on who you're asking. If I have fear of heights and I have fear of darkness and I have fear of Muslims, whether a scientific person will say it's good, logical or not, is one thing, but for me, it makes sense. You cannot talk a person who has a phobia on the basis that, you know, this is irrational, so your phobia should go away. It doesn't go away. The point is, the rationality is in the eyes of the beholder. There is a certain person who is says my logic is objective. I'm not subject to all this, so I don't believe in all this. I think you're full of nonsense and it's all irrational. But try convincing somebody who's suffering. So the person who has this X, Y, whatever phobia believes that it's realistic, believes that it's reasonable. And so that is where the term, how the term in practice is being used, how the term is getting emotional currency. You have to look at a term getting emotional currency rather than scientifically, logically, whether that's true or false. It may be totally false, but the program is not what was applicable to what Hindus were doing. It may be logically, scientifically wrong, but if you can get away with it, if you can build that kind of an aura around a certain brand, you can use it, and it's a power word. So I'm basically saying that the second level is pragmatic. If I can turn Hindu phobia and give it the same currency as Islamophobia has, as long as I can do it for the law in the legal situation, as long as if there's a panel discussion at Princeton University discussing Islamophobia, and I write to the organizers saying, can I also be a panelist or at least ask a question from the audience about Hindu phobia, it's very difficult for them to refuse it. It's just a pragmatic matter. Well, it doesn't have anything to do with what's the logic. I think the people who are promoting Hindu Misi are splitting hair too much about the logic behind it, but in media and in emotions and in what becomes eventually turns into law, it's not all those things that matter. What matters is the people's feelings. And how can you arouse people's feelings to give us sympathy the way the Muslims are getting sympathy? And how do you arouse people's feelings to give us protection, legal protection, the way Muslims are getting legal protection when they're being criticized? And the criticism of Islam, which gets immediately branded as Islamophobia, is not just fear of Islam. If I say that, that this Eid teaches you slitting throats because you have to worship halal. Halal is a cruel, and halal is against animal rights. And when you practice halal and you keep slitting throats slowly, 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 then, you know, one day it's easy for you to slit the throat of a human being who's an infidel. And so therefore you're programming these young boys using this halal to become killers. If I say that, you know, that is Islamophobic. So it is any disparaging, anything that says that if you say hypothetically that Prophet Muhammad didn't exist and they just made it up. Now that's not fear. That's just saying this all bullshit, but that would be called Islamophobic. So the currency of Islamophobia has to do with the wide range of applications, not limited to, okay, whether I'm afraid of Islam and all that. They don't say that the test of Islamophobia is whether you're afraid of Islam. You make fun of the Prophet, you are Islamophobic.
Now,
I'll tell you, the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom, which was started by the Clinton administration, and I'm the only Hindu I know of who actually goes to them. Actually, Washington, D.C., goes to the headquarters, sits with the commissioners, argues with them, and writes back my rebuttal. I've done that on multiple occasions. So on one of these occasions, this was years ago before COVID, when I went there, and they had this report on, Islamophobia in India. Okay. So they had this report accusing, India Hindus and all that of Islamophobia. So I started taking it apart. One of the clauses was that they're banning beef. They're banning beef. And I said, what does that have to do with Islamophobia? See, banning beef doesn't mean you have fear of Islam. You're not. Banning beef is that, you want to protect cows and this and that. So they said, this lady there, she was this white lady, very leftist kind of, very angry kind of at me, you know. So she's one of those commissioners. So she said that you are denying them the right to practice their religion. That's why it's a violation. So I said, then we got this argument on whether beef eating is required in Islam. It turns out the Quran doesn't say that you have to eat beef. In fact, cow is a tropical animal. It's not a desert animal. They don't have cows in the time of Muhammad. It was a luxury to only some very super rich people would import cattle, you know, cows. They ate goat and camel. So during the Muslim, you know, holidays or whatever ritual, for whatever reason, whenever they would eat meat, it was not beef. So I told her that. I said that, you know, if you ban beef eating, that has nothing to do with Islamophobia. So you see the how the word Islamophobia has traveled and become so pervasive that our conversation had nothing to do with fearing Islam. It had to do with protecting cows. And she felt that denying them the ritual that the religion requires them, you know, is therefore Islamophobia. So this is what you have to understand. The meaning of the word phobia cannot be taken literally when we figure out whether a word is useful.
Yeah, so when you were talking about Islam and the Quran, for example, and when you were talking about Islam's prophet, my heart skipped a beat and I felt genuine fear. And that fear is not irrational, because when you make such statements, you have thousands and lakhs of Muslims taking to the streets saying Gustakhe Rasool ki ek hi saza sartan se juda. And that's where my problem essentially, you know, I'm a little confused whether Hindu phobia is an all-encompassing term, because we can legitimately say that the fear of Islam is not irrational. The fear of Islam is genuine, because there have been thousands and lakhs of people who've lost their lives because of the doctrine of Islam. And there haven't been people who have lost their lives because Hindus choose to follow the religion that they do. And therefore, the fear, so-called, is completely irrational. And I don't know how the two can go hand in hand, where you discredit one, but use the other.
Yeah, I understand. But see, the thing is that Misia is hardly a term that anybody in India knows. And it's hardly a term that anybody is going to start using. It's going to become some very esoteric, a few people who will talk to themselves, talk to each other, and they feel very proud. We've got coined a new term. We must be very smart and pat each other's back. But good luck trying to make it mainstream the way we made mainstream Hindu phobia in many, many circles. We still have a long way to go to get on par with Islamophobia. But every time they talk Islamophobia, we bring in Hindu phobia and we score points. Hindu Misya, nobody knows what the heck it is. Our own people even don't even know what the heck it is. Go to any guru and you say Hindu phobia, they'll understand it. Go to any RSS fellow, you say, you know, I'm accusing these people of Hindu phobia. Talk to them, any Indian consulate anywhere, they'll understand it. Okay. More and more people are understanding it. Hindu Misya, you're going to start at square one. And, you know, we are so good at fragmenting. And for the sake of being very theoretically pure and all that, we start something, it never goes anywhere. It will probably decorate a few websites and a few, you know, letterheads of people who become advisor and director and trustee of this or that organization to do with Hindu Misya and all that. But it has very little chance of making an impact in the world. And it really has nothing to do with what it means. Besides, it's not even our word. It's not even our word. It's not alien to our languages. Misya. What does Misya? You know, phobia also is alien, but it's a very common word, you know, because the people have understood. And I think it's a very clever idea to piggyback on Islamophobia and just go for it. And I think that when Suraj Jengde starts saying that 500,000 Dalits women have been raped by Muslims, and therefore, I mean, by Hindus, Brahmins, and therefore they should be, we should be denied our rights as Hindus, he is spreading Hindu phobia because that is what he is spreading. Whether it is rational or not, I remind you, is irrelevant. Whether it is backed by hard data is irrelevant. You see, while Islamophobia, you could say, okay, it's backed by hard evidence because they did kill. My father was in Lahore and barely made it to India during partition. And he was very young. He was a young man, just newly married. And many members of his family did not make it. My father luckily did. Okay. And my mother was in Ludhiana on the Indian side. And they thought that these people are dead. So, you know, it's in my family. I understand this. I understand Islamophobia. I definitely understand it. And I understand that Islamophobia is rational. Hindu phobia is not rational. Okay. Islamophobia is backed by facts. I can legitimately say I am Islamophobic and I have a right to be. I can say that because my father almost died. And these were the stories taught to me since childhood. Okay. So if I am the son of victims I have a right to fear that. It's normal. I mean, a woman who's been raped or her mother was raped, she's going to be fearful of rapists. Well, you cannot accuse her that, hey, you're fearing rapists. She'll say, yeah, I'm fearing rapists, and for a good reason. So I have a right to be Islamophobic, I could argue. Okay. But I don't think that Suraj Yengde can make the same argument that he has a right to be Hinduphobic. Okay. But that's the argument they're making. So that's the argument that Sandhya Rajan is making and all these people are making, that they have a logical, based on data, they keep fabricating this data, that they have a right to be Hinduphobic, okay, because it's all logic that the data-based that Hindus and Brahmins and all that have been killing Muslims and killing Dalits and raping women and all that stuff. So it's a war of claims and counterclaims. And it's not that there is the truth that everybody believes. You believe in a certain truth about Islam. And in fact, a lot of historians deny that. You know that a lot of historians deny this whole business about whether Ghazni came and killed all those people or not. A lot of them say that Muslims came to liberate the Dalits. That's the idea. The argument, the leftist argument of Indian history is that caste system oppressed the people. Brahmins oppressed the people. Muslims came to liberate, and the reason the Hindus failed to defend themselves is because only the upper caste wanted to fight. The lower caste was very happy that, oh, wow, these guys came to liberate us. Now, it may be ridiculous, but that's the narrative. So, you see, we cannot say that in one case the fear is there, in the other case the fear is not there. The point is, when it comes to Hinduism, they're spreading Hinduphobia intensely. That's the whole woke movement today, to spread Hinduphobia. Even claiming that we are doing pogroms is a way to spread Hinduphobia. And we should call it that. We should say, by making the allegation of pogroms, you are being Hinduphobic. That's what we should say.
Right. So I agree with you. It is Hinduphobic because it is irrational what they're claiming, because they're not backed with facts.
Yes.
And your fear of Islam, for example, or my fear of Islam is not Islamophobic because it's rational. There is a basis for that fear. And that is where my confusion lies. But what I understand you saying is...
I would say whether the fear is rational or irrational should not be the point. If a community has fear of something, whatever it may be due to, it may be logical, illogical, maybe bad propaganda, maybe whatever. As long as a community has fear of something, you know, there is that phobia. Okay. And so what we are being told is that Muslims have Hindu phobia. They say it's justified. Dalits have Hindu phobia. Women are being persecuted. Christians, all of these people got Hindu phobia. That is how they are going after Hindus. By making that allegation, you and I can say it's irrational. We don't have a problem. No, as long as they got the bullhorn, they got the microphone, they got the international media, they got the social media under their control, they got the legal systems under their control, the human rights administrators under their control, even the Indian Chandrachud, the Supreme Court justice, part of this. As long as the power structure of knowledge and legal things and policy things is controlled by certain people who believe there is legitimacy in accusing Hindus, okay, they're in accusing Hindus and having as people that have committed crimes, okay, as long as they can get away with it, and they're talking about it all the time. In Tamil Nadu, some government people are talking like that, you know, Stalin and his people are talking like that. As long as that is the case, I have a right to say those are Hinduphobic. They should not be is another matter. Their Hinduphobia is irrational. It's a false propaganda. That's a different matter. But the fact that they are making those claims makes them Hinduphobic.
So what I understand you saying is that logically the... epidemiology of the word phobia and the word mesia doesn't really matter, because Islamophobia has come to mean fear and hatred combined of Muslims, for example. Rational, irrational, it doesn't matter. Whether the word phobia means rational or irrational, it doesn't matter. What you're saying is because of repeated usage and because of how the Muslim Brotherhood has used it, because of how the left has used it, the term Islamophobia itself has come to mean a combined fear and hatred of the Muslim community. And therefore, we should be taking from that, we should be piggybacking on that lexicon and sticking to Hindu phobia without, you know, squabbling over whether phobia is irrational fear or rational fear, etc.
Yes, I do. I think you summarized my position brilliantly. That's exactly my position. I'm a pragmatist. I don't want to be a purist theoretically. I mean, I can fight a theoretical game also, but I think that in the world of marketing, brands are very pragmatic. Brands are extremely pragmatic. You've figured out the psychology of people. So right now, the world is in this mode of political correctness, and when you accuse somebody of something, where you've come up with a scary connotation, he wants to say, oh, no, I'll avoid that and I'll take the safe route. I want to create Hindu phobia like that. That, you know, hey, listen, in fact, I'm coming up with the rankings of Hindu phobic people. I'm developing, you're doing that too. We're going to do that. We have a Hindu phobia of the year award we should give somebody. We should have a conference on who are the top 10 Hindu phobics this year. And we should keep pushing back on them. And it is not about whether their fear is rational or irrational. I don't care. As long as they are disparaging my tradition, I'm going to fight back using the same ammunition that the Muslims are fighting. It's as simple as that. It's all about respect for our identity that can be passed on to the next generation. Whereas these allegations, true or false, even if they're true, doesn't matter. They're going to prevent current generation from passing it on to the next generation, that particular identity. Nobody wants to be associated with an identity that has such negative baggage. So it's a fight for, it's a smear war, smear campaign against each other. And that's the way that life is. And so I'm a very pragmatic person. You want to call me Islamophobic, I'm going to call you Hinduphobic, for sure. And I'm going to come up with my criteria for escaping Hinduphobic branding. I'm going to come up with my criteria. And otherwise, I'm going to go after you. And I have millions of people now who want to back me in this. I worked very hard for it for 30 years. So I would not give it up.
Now, Rajiv, sir, as far as Hindu Mesia is concerned, there are certain crimes, there are hate crimes. So Hindu phobia, if we talk about using that term when there is hate speech against Hindus, calls for genocide, etc., it would still, fit somewhere. But when you start talking about hate crimes, for example, I've, you know, repeatedly spoken about this case where a young girl, 14-year-old, she was being gang raped, for example. And she kept saying, mujhe bhagwan ke liye chhod do. And the rapist kept saying, nahi, you have to say, mujhe Allah ke liye chhod do. Now, that is not phobia that drove those rapists to rape that poor Hindu girl. It was absolute unbridled hate for a kafir girl that drove them to rape her. Now, do you think, as far as hate crimes are concerned, Hindu phobia as a term is again inadequate, and maybe we should differentiate that hate speech is Hindu phobia, but hate crimes, we perhaps need to discuss what we could call it. We could perhaps call it crimes against Hindus, Hindu hate crimes against Hindus, so on and so forth, if not Hindu Mesia. But do you think that differentiation and categorization should be there?
So, you know, if you look at Christianity's hatred for infidels is because there's a fear that they're spoiling the, it's a collective salvation in Christianity, it's a collective salvation, and these infidels are spoiling the game for everybody. So it is fear. So the fact that you don't believe in Jesus and is spoiling my chance also, you see. The it's a collective bargain that God has given, and I have been asked to get you in line. I have to force you to stand in line, get back on track, become a Christian, become a believer, because your disbelief is harming me. You are causing me harm. I'm afraid of my hatred for you is because it's a problem for me. You see, this is Hindus don't understand it, because in our case, we have a reincarnation system. It's not like we're all going to go this way or that way kind of thing. And so under the reincarnation system, you go to hell or you come back and be born in another life in some way. I'm not bothered. I'm going to go, in my next life, if there is one, will be based on my karma, and if maybe not even have a next life if I don't have to go through that again. So the worldview we have, the cosmology we have, it gives an individual more freedom. There's more individual freedom, you're not contingent on other people. And the collectivism that is part of all the Abrahamic religions, because God gives covenants collectively. And that is why there is this tendency that certain people will go around the world conquering others and getting them to be converted, because it is required. So I think the common man's hatred is out of greed. He just wants this guy's gold chain. That's all. Okay, whether it is against this one or that one, that's all it is. But the ideological foundation for it is based on this fear of disobedience to God, because God has mandated and ordered us to go and do certain things. We cannot disobey. And the kafir has to be treated a certain way. We cannot be allowed into the Kaaba. It's not just hatred for him. It is fear of disobedience. So ultimately, these religions live on fear. They are based, the whole Abrahamic tradition, Abrahamic religious driving force is fear. God is a fearful guy. Okay, all the commandments and injunctions and surahs are to put fear in people and drive them in a certain direction. And so whenever they have this attitude towards somebody and all that, they may pretend, I don't like your rationality, you're a nice guy. But deep down, unconsciously, they have so much fear.
So what you're saying is their hatred towards Hindus and what drives them to commit these crimes against Hindus, whether it's the rape, whether it's the beheading, whether it's the forced conversion, so on and so forth, forced feeding beef, for example, is not... I mean, the hatred of Hindu is there, but the hatred of Hindu is a product of their fear of their vengeful God. That if they don't follow those commandments,
yes,
then they are not going to get the Jannah, their 72 hoods, so on and so forth, whatever their religion promises them in their afterlife.
Right.
So they're not going to get that.
Yeah. So I think there's two levels. There is an unconscious level, which is fear. That is the driver. The primary driver in the Abrahamic religions is fear. I mean, that's clear to me. Now, that manifests in many ways. You can manifest it and make it look like, we are positive people, we are all positive, this is all, we want to embrace everybody. You can turn it into a conscious, at the conscious level, you can make it look very politically correct, and you can make it look like very reasonable and scientific and rational, you're doing all these things. But that is just a surface level. That is a surface level on which you can say, the reason I hate you is because, you guys are not very clean, or you guys are polluting because of Diwali crackers. I like that. Those are all surface manifestations which may come in the form of hatred, disliking, logically arguing against them. But underneath all that is fear. And the person may not even be aware that he's driven by fear, because this has been coming down for so long. And this has been put into him. When the kid is very young, he's beaten up and told, you do this, and don't do that. I mean, it's all through danda. And it's all through danda because the dad or whoever is in charge feels that God has empowered him to do God's danda. Man is doing God's danda. I mean, I remember... living room conversation with Ram Jethmalani. I used to, Rani Jethmalani's daughter, Ram Jethmalani, when they lived in this Akbar Road, I used to go there and have a lot of good times, many, many evenings. Now, Rani had adopted a young Muslim boy. I don't know if you know this, but Irani had adopted a Muslim boy. She found him in her train and she brought him and illegally adopted him and all that. So he was always present. And there would be this fiery debate between Ram Jethmalani and this son. And Ram Jethmalani would give him hell on many of the things that we are talking about, that, you know, he would make this point that because you have this fear, you are driven into all kind of, you're projecting the fear on others, you know, you're blaming these kafirs, you don't want to work hard and feel that you're a victim. Basically, the fear is crippling you and handicapping you and preventing you from working hard and doing well in life. And look at the, he was very open about it. He would say, your Hindu classmates are able to outperform because they don't have this fear. They're out of freedom. They're more free. So I think there is a fear. I've seen this fear in Jews and Christians whom I've known for most of my life living in this country. I also have Muslim friends. And I tell you, the Muslim friends are so slick and so charming and so nice and congenial, very hospitable. They got beautiful homes and they are so friendly and loving and they're there for you. They'll give you a ride. They'll take you somewhere. They'll lavishly entertain you. They're really nice about that. If you start peeling the onion layers and start sitting with one or two of them, you know, and going in it little bit, that fear comes out and they don't want to talk anymore. They stop the conversation. They stop the conversation because that you're taking them to a place they don't want to go to. So I think we need to understand their vulnerabilities also, their psychological vulnerabilities. When we're able to articulate clearly, with evidence, the fear as a driving force in all their religious books, that is the primary driving force. And the fear of damnation, you know, the fear of damnation, the fear of hell. I mean, they're different in the three traditions. They have different kinds of ways that God is fearful and condemning and all that stuff. But that is the reality in all of them.
So then you would propose that Hindu phobia as a term is used not just for hate speech, but also hate crime. So we say it's a Hindu phobic attack. It's a Hindu phobic crime. It's a Hindu phobic hate speech and so on and so forth. So do you think the word Hindu misia should be abandoned completely? Because I was researching while I was preparing for this interview, and I realized that a lot of leftists are now actually trying to mainstream misia as a suffix. So a lot of the trans community, the LGBTQ community, is trying to mainstream misia, saying that transphobia or homophobia is a term which is not encompassing and it's not adequate to, in their mind, describe the kind of hate that members of the LGBTQ community get on a global stage. So they are trying to mainstream the term misia. So do you think this is the point where we should completely drop Hindu misia as a project?
Yeah, I think so. And I think that I know a lot of the trans people. I mean, I talk to them. In fact, I have a lot of interactions with them. They don't, I mean, the average person feels that differently, feels that, you know, there is this sense that if you look at the right wing, if you look at in the American context, the right wing, Republican right wing, fight against LGBTQ and trans in the school systems. It is fear. It is fear that this is contaminating our family values. It is contaminating being a good Christian. Because you can ask them, why are you concerned your kid goes to school and the other people are like that? Why should you be bothered? And there is a fear that it is entering our lives. It'll destroy our society. There is the fear of LGBTQ kind of making us less Christian, less loving, you know, normal, less normal. There is that fear. So that the LGBTQ people saying, okay, all you guys have a transphobia and whatever, you know, they're from their point of view, that makes sense. I don't think that is going to go away, that kind of a branding is going to go away in the near future.
So Hindus should simply drop Hindu Mesia as a project and stop trying to reinvent the wheel, stick to Hindu phobia. I'm
I
sorry,
think
we
so.
should drop Hindu Mesia as a
Yes.
project and stick to Hindu phobia as far
Because
as lexicon is
this
concerned.
whole Mesia business is just a few years old. You know,
Right.
and it's ironic, the same people tried something else first. I won't name names, but first they tried saying that this Rajiv Malhotra never came up with Hindu phobia. He should not be given any credit for it. Hindu phobia so-and-so had, so-and-so also mentioned. It was more like trying to claim words as if that matters, you know. So I let me also tell you one thing. My life contribution is not about coining words. Even though this conversation is on how important coining words is, I am more interested in discovering the phenomenon itself, the algorithm which describes that word. What is the algorithm of Hindu phobia? Why? What is the, is it Freudian psychoanalysis as a lens that drives them in this direction? Is it is it Christianity? Is it, what is it? What are the mechanisms? What are the funding mechanisms that are driving it? What are the political mechanisms, pragmatic mechanisms? What are the financial mechanisms that are driving it? I'm more interested in understanding it as a phenomena, and whatever you call it, you call it. I happen to pick pragmatic terms to describe the things. You know, like, for instance, I feel that our people just didn't want to study enough about the other side, because we felt that I have the truth in my heart and we've had the truth for 5,000 years and why should I worry about others and I don't believe in being negative. So I found that the word Purva Paksha was very pragmatic. I could go to everyone, to the Shankaracharya downwards and say, you know, we have a tradition of Purva Paksha. We have to study others. That is what we, our rishis were good at. That is, they were good at debating. We cannot say that I don't care about what others are thinking. We have to care about what others are thinking. And then you have to educate society how to debate and how to argue back. So connecting it with our tradition, I didn't invent the term Purva Paksha, but I applied it to, in today's context, in a way that it had not been applied. So, you know, I'm a pragmatist. I look at an issue, I look at a situation, and I figure out what's the right way to tackle it and push back. And I come up with some solution. And it may require coining a new term, or it may require refurbishing an old term, you know, repurposing an old term for a new application. Whatever it takes, I just want to build movements where our young people are able to join in on a large scale without necessarily having to be too erudite. I write very heavy books for scholars, but I also spend a lot of energy trying to simplify it for the masses so that people, a large number of people, can join it. Both these domains are important.
So actually, I did try to research where Hindu Mesia actually started, and I couldn't come up with an answer because I couldn't sort of go back in time and trace that trajectory. But I do realize it's a new phenomenon. It's just been maybe 3-4 years that a lot of people are trying to perhaps talk about it in mainstream. It's, I didn't know the backstory that there has been that conversation about Hindu phobia versus Hindu Mesia, as far as those who are trying to mainstream that term versus you who's worked on Hindu phobia. However, my last question is, say Hindus get together and decide that, all right, we are going to use Hindu Mesia, just hypothetically. What kind of momentum do you think are we going to lose with that? And what effect would the cluttering of terminology, so to speak, have on the momentum that we've already built so far?
So, you know, the thing is, let's do the scenario that you're talking about, that these guys continue pursuing Hindu Mesia. Fine. I mean, they can do anything they want. It's just that Hindu phobia has a life of its own. It is way ahead, and that's not going to stop. I mean, there are Hindu phobia, you know, mentions in the Canadian. There's some bill going on, and they're putting it in the school district here. There are some school districts that have included a sensitivity on Hindu phobia as part of that term is there as part of the curriculum. So, you know, we are getting in there. So the Hindu Mesia people, by the time they are where we already are with Hindu phobia, it may be many, many years if they ever get there. And in the meantime, Hindu phobia, the idea of building awareness of Hindu phobia will go even further. I mean, now there are in the American Academy of Religion, they have formed these committees to say that, you know, we should be honest and we should also self-introspect and whether we really have Hinduphobia. I mean, now these the guys who are on the other side, and the Wendy Donegans of the world, have retiring or they're very old and, you know, they've fought this with me and they lost all this stuff. Then they put the next generation like Audrey Truscott type people to fight, continue the fight. But the Audrey Truscott type people, thanks to our activism against them, what has happened is polarized their camp. There are, for every one Audrey Truscott, there are one, two, three, four others who don't want to get labeled, who don't want this branding. They just don't want to, you know, Audrey Truscott has a hard time getting people on her panels. You think that she's that powerful. She is a very violent kind of intellectually, in an intellectual sense, a very violent kind of person, a very negative, full of hatred and all that. And she's definitely a Hinduphobic. The thing is that she has not the unanimous support of her own you know, peer group. Many people in that, in Rutgers University where she is and other universities where she goes and talks and all that, tell me that they want to stay away from her very nicely and politely. They don't want to be in a fight with anybody, but they do not want to be co-branded with her because they think that maybe she's got enough support, enough church support or wherever who's supporting her, so she'll be okay. But if we latch on to her, if we are associated with her, we don't have the same support and we'll be screwed. We don't want to do that. So a lot of people are actually abandoning her. So it is working. It is working, you know. So if it's working, let it continue. But I'm not concerned. See, I'm 73 years old and I've had a 30, 35 years of all this. And so I'm moving on. I have to now pack my bags and turn over. I'm writing, by the way, next year, just to let you know, Infinity Foundation turns 30 years old. So we've been at it longer than anyone else. We've started most of these new things long before today's generation even knew about these problems. So I have to turn this over to new people. I have to produce at least 20 more books I have to finish that I've started, a lot of them with new kind of movements and new initiatives. Totally new domains of research and investigation. I have to finish that, train a lot of young people. I would love to have you join us as one of the bright young future leaders. You are highly promising, I know that. But we are doing that. So for me, you know, at this point in time, it doesn't matter if somebody starts another movement, they call it Hindu Misi or whatever, you know, more power to them, bless them. I have no problem of any kind. It doesn't really affect me. I just have to finish my work and move on and let others do whatever they do. The future belongs to young people and they should decide for themselves.
I hope we do come to the right decision collectively, because it is becoming increasingly important for the global community to realize the kind of hate and violence the Hindu community has faced for decades and centuries. In fact, again, recently, I think Hindus are being endangered over and over and over again when the Hitler hooked cross is conflated with the Hindu holy swastika, for example. And these little threads of hatred and fear towards Hindus, it keeps endangering our community almost on a regular basis. So
Nupur. Yeah. Before I forget, you've just given a very good example. You know, yes. Fear of swastika is not a hatred in some kind of rational or, you know, it's a fear of swastika based on completely bogus grounds. Completely bogus grounds. Here is an example of Hinduphobia. You know, every Hindu in the United States, I mean, I went to my car. I just got a new car, so I went to the temple and I put a nice swastika. I had the Pandit bless. It's on the front of my car. And I have no problem with it. I have a swastika hanging in various places here and there. I have no problem with it. I have no, because I can explain. I can argue. I look for an opportunity when somebody picks on me and says, oh, no, what's this? Then I give them a long story and they'll say, okay, fine. You know, I don't lose easily. Okay. So the point is that I see, as somebody who has a swastika in various places around me in my life, I see that there is that swastika is a sort of a hatred for swastika is a kind of a Hindu phobic thing. It is all phobia about, you know, these Nazis. The RSS are wearing these shorts, these khaki shorts, and they have a Nazi background and all that. It is fear. The propaganda against RSS is a phobia. There is RSS phobia. There is no doubt about it. There is Brahmin phobia. There is no doubt about it. Brahmin phobia exists. So, you know, Hindu phobia is a kind of a catch-all, very generic kind of broad umbrella that captures all of these. There is phobia of, you know, there is a whole movement that says that Ram is a male oppressor, is a male dominant guy, a female oppressor, Sita was oppressed. And there is a Ram phobia movement definitely going on. There is all of this. There is a Sanskrit phobia. In fact, I wrote an article. I just discovered this. Sanskrit phobia and geopolitics. I wrote this article and published it in 2005 in the Journal of Sanskrit Studies, which I launched, and Infinity Foundation funded this journal in Thailand in 2005. This was launched by the Crown Princess, the King's daughter. And so I wrote this whole thing about the phobia being propagated, irrational, of course, that Sanskrit is a violent language, it has been oppressive, and it preaches violence against certain communities and things like that. And this Sheldon Pollack was actually one of the pioneers in bringing that message, that interpretation of Sanskrit. And that is why I did not want him to take over the Shingeri chair and all those things and take over Sanskrit studies. And that is why I wrote The Battle for Sanskrit, to fight back that Sanskrit phobia. So there are these very dangerous hatred based on fear and fear-mongering. There is that.
So Rajiji, it's been 30 years next year that you've been running your foundation.
And by the way, you have to come. You have to come. It'll be in August. And I'm telling I want a promise from you in front of your audience. You have to come and be part of the celebration of our 30th anniversary. We expect about 2,000 people. And you must come. And I hope many other people will also come. We want to do it on a big scale. The whole history of this movement from 30 years, we want to put it on display. Where we are now, what is our vision for the future? Launch a whole lot of new programs. We're working very hard to announce many new programs at that event. So I'll let you know the date, and you cannot miss it, please. My request.
I will. No, not at all, sir. I will certainly be there. And I hugely admire you. And like I've always said, people like me, or even people who've been working in this field for 10 years more than I have, I'm just 10 years old, we stand on the shoulder of giants and we always learn. And I'm happy that we could have this conversation. I perhaps have a lot more clarity on the terms Hindu-phobia and Hindu-mesia, and I hope that our audience has as well. So thank you so much, Rajivji. I will see you in August when we celebrate 30 years of the foundation.
Yes, and before that, sometime early in 2024, I'll be visiting Delhi, and I would love to invite you, and we'll sit down and talk and do other things. And before that, I'm sure we'll have more conversations online also. And I want to tell viewers that Nupur is an exceedingly sharp, clear, straight, you know, shooter, and I've really enjoyed reading her stuff and enjoyed interacting with her. It's been a delight. I really enjoyed this conversation because you brought out some. You forced me to think, and argue, and that's the best. You know, I really like a logical, penetrating analysis, or critiquing my thinking, and that gets the best out of me. So people can agree, disagree, but that's the best I have to offer. And this is what we ought to be doing: is bringing the best out of each other. And thank you very much for doing that.
Thank you so much, Rajiji. Thank you so much for the time you've given. And thank you for your extremely kind and tall words. And I hope to see you soon. Thank you.
Thank you. Namaste.